You're listening to Strictly Business Podcast with Lindsay Williams.
It's Wednesday, so it's time for Wayne on Wednesday. Wayne McCurry is a portfolio manager at FNB Wealth and Investment in Johannesburg. I've just been looking through the sort of headlines of the midterm budget policy statement delivered by the minister today in South Africa. Wayne, I can't get too excited, but then again, there were no big surprises that would cause anyone concern either, I don't think.
You know, there shouldn't be any big surprises, because that's why we do this medium-term budget. You know, in stark contrast to way things were run, let's say, in sort of up until the late 80s, where every budget was a surprise. You didn't know what was coming around the corner, you know. So it's a very good – it's actually good news that there are no surprises on the budget. And I would say on the medium-term budget –
yes.
I would say on balance, not bad news, you know.
No, nothing bad.
Okay,
I mean,
yeah.
They didn't come out with any controversial tax statements or anything. They said, you know, revenue's a bit down, so deficits will widen and that sort of thing. But nothing as a portfolio manager, you would say, goodness me, I've got to sit down with the team and we've got to change our allocation to this sector or that sector. Nothing like that, I don't think.
No, nothing like it at all. And that, of course, is good news.
Yes.
You know, so there shouldn't be any surprise. It should just, in essence, be a little bit of an update of the budget or the last medium-term budget or the last set of statements they came up with. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's good. So would you say then that when you look at the political environment in South Africa, we all know about the government of national unity and it's still finding its feet. But would you say that the Treasury and the Reserve Bank are in good hands, and those two pillars are very, very important?
Yes, I mean, the Reserve Bank and Treasury. You know, the Reserve Bank, you know, ever since, I think, 1988 was the actual time. But the Reserve Bank's been in good hands for a substantial time period. And, you know, the Department of Finance, other than that one. Well, no, the Department of Finance was fine. It was just a SARS that was captured. But, you know, other than that, it's actually been fine.
Good. Okay. So,
I don't think there's any concerns there at all.
Good. Gratifyingly boring, in other words. Let's have a quick look.
As I said, that's exactly the way it should be.
Yeah, quite right. We don't need surprises in our lives. Just want to talk about one company. We don't normally talk about company specifics. We talk about generalities on this Wednesday afternoon. But I saw Impala coming out with the first quarter production report, and the share price on my screen, which is delayed, but doesn't matter, down nearly 6%. Is that indicative of Impala's problems or the whole sector's problems?
No, I think the whole sector's going to get back on production.
Hmm.
For whatever reasons they give, is they're not making money. And when you're not making money, you know, you don't actually mine the ore bodies that are the most marginal. So, yeah, I think we're going to see that from everyone. And that's part of the reasons why we could possibly get some sort of recovery in the platinum and palladium basket. Although the actual underlying metals have run relatively hard. You know, they're both well over, nicely over 1,000. So, yeah, and Impala as a share, I mean, it touched a 52-week high yesterday.
Ah, okay. Well, in that case, that's good. So would you rather have less production but higher prices or the other way around? It seems to me that
certainly in a falling price environment, you want less production.
Yeah.
You know, especially in something like platinum and palladium, where there is clearly, you know, limited supply.
This is what is interesting, because if you're a trader, for example, you come in the morning, you turn on your screen, you look at the metals prices in US dollar terms, you look at gold and platinum and palladium and rhodium and lithium, all these things, and you see them up $20 an ounce or something. You say to yourself, well, that's good. Let's have a look at Impala, Anglo-American Platinum, etc. Because in the future, I know it's not easy to turn on extra production, but in the future you can ease new production into the system and therefore benefit from the higher prices, or you can use the derivatives market. What is the psychology of an investor like yourself, an investor not in the physical metal but in the equity market?
You know, look, I mean, you when prices are depressed, you actually want lower production for two reasons. First of all, you want the platinum mines themselves to mine the more profitable ore bodies, you know, not do the marginal stuff, because then at least they get a lower cost per ounce or per kilogram produced. And then you also, in a strategic metal like platinum and that, you actually want less production around to actually boost the price. Because the one nice thing about platinum and palladium, there's no substitution.
You mean someone can't just come along and say, oh, we'll use this instead?
We'll use something else. And they're a good example, and a good friend of mine actually pointed it out to me earlier on today.
Mm.
You know, when the whole Russia-Ukraine thing started, and people just said, you know, no more gas out of Russia, and there was substitute. You could get gas somewhere else.
Yeah, but with South Africa having a 76%, I think it is a virtual monopoly on the production of platinum group metals. That just can't happen unless they suddenly find something in Iceland or something.
Yeah, which doesn't seem likely.
Highly unlikely.
Yeah, actually, but I mean, platinum and palladium, I've said it so many times, it's just going through a standard cycle.
Hmm.
You know, there's nothing unusual about what's happening now. It's happened many times before and will happen also many times into the future. So there's nothing at all unusual about what's happening right now.
Good. As we've said a couple of times in this brief chat, we don't like unusual. We like boring, regular
like to be bored.
Sort of stuff. Yes, it's lovely to be bored.
We like boring is good.
It really is. Very, very underrated. These people going off and jumping off mountains and things and doing extreme sports. No, we don't need that in metaphorically and physically. We don't need it.
No.
Wayne, what about the...
Investments, if you... I suppose if you got a well-balanced portfolio and, you know, your days should be boring.
Predictable as well as boring. And maybe we shouldn't say boring. Maybe we should debate. We need the predictability of returns. Some people will be striving for 40, 50% because they've found this latest biotech or tech stock or AI stock or something like that. But on the other hand, yes, that's fine. But get a small exposure to the go-getting stocks. But on the other hand, you need just good, solid stuff that every year you beat inflation, you get dividends, and away you go. Isn't that the way to do it?
I would think so. Look, you've got to have exposure. You've got to have some exposure to the new age, new wave, new thing.
Yes.
Because, you know, they always perform extremely well in the beginning. You know, they knock the socks off absolutely everything else. Sometimes they just disappear thereafter. Sometimes they are still around. And I think that is the case with AI. You know, these companies are not going to disappear. They're not going anywhere. But the share prices may be a little bit elevated at the moment. So, yeah, I think that's what you do is you know, if you think the share prices are way too expensive, don't have nothing, but maybe be underweight.
Final question on equities anyway. When it comes to falling interest rates, it's obviously very good because it boosts the economy and therefore more people use banks and there's more transactions and there's more transactional income and so it goes on. But is a shrinking interest rate environment good for margins for banks or is a rising interest rate market? How does it work?
A rising interest rate is better.
Yes.
Initially. The way it works is, and certainly I can't talk about overseas banks because they have a different business model, but the way it works domestically is that if interest rates go up, your overdraft, your mortgage bond, your house loan, your motor car loan, you are charged that same interest rate immediately, that new interest rate immediately.
Yeah.
Bank get their finance from. They've issued out notes and taken on money from pension funds, from the money market, from all over the place, normally over a time period, 3 months, 6 months, 2 years, you know, whatever note they've used. That only reprices when it comes up to maturity. So immediately you get a margin enhancement. And then obviously exactly the opposite happens when rates fall. Of course, banks do hedge out a lot of this because they just go into the interest rate futures market and take positions in that market. But by and large, when interest rates fall, there's a margin squeeze short term, but that's only short term because banks actually want lower interest rates because then they can lend more money.
I find that the rapacious nature of the corporate world, whether it be a grocery chain or whether it be a bank, is a little bit distasteful because of what you've just said. As soon as interest rates go up, then your mortgage bond or your credit card or your motor car loan goes up. When they come down, it takes a while for it to filter through the system. It's the same as if, let's say that a loaf of bread in the United States costs $5. And because of what happened with Russia and Ukraine, the price of wheat goes up and therefore you're charged $6 a week later because of the international price of wheat on the Chicago Board of Trade. When the price reverts, which it has done, do you see the price coming down from $6 to $5 again? No, you don't. They keep it up there because you become used to it. And I find that that's what I think Kamala Harris would call price gouging. I think that's what she means by that, because they don't pass on the reduction in prices, but they're very quick to pass on the rise in prices to the poor, beleaguered consumer.
But then you must remember the one thing we all rely on. You rely on the capitalistic system and competition. That some guy's going to say, I can sell bread, a little bit more bread, if I'm 10 cents lower than the other guy. But yeah, I agree with you. It prices go up immediately, but they don't always fall straight away. But you know, you rely on competition to give you credible pricing structures in various altered circumstances. That's why the capitalistic system works and the command system doesn't work essentially over time. Is that the market must determine prices. And no matter what politicians might want, I also heard the vice president last night saying, ex-president Trump saying, we're going to bring down costs. You can't just bring down costs.
Of course you can't.
This is political talk, man. You can't. You're in a capitalistic system. The market's way bigger than any president. It's significantly bigger than any president. So you've got to say, well, look, if prices have gone up, if the food inflation was 10 or 12% for a year, like it was in the UK, then prices are just higher. You can't bring them down. You can maybe do a little bit of subsidization at fringe and make a big political hoo-ah out of it, but you can't reduce the cost of living.
No,
it's just politics. It's politics.
Yeah, well, Donald Trump and politics—they shouldn't be in the same sentence, actually. Because, but anyway, this is just me, and I mustn't get on my high horse. But he said in the first year, energy prices in the United States will fall by 50%. I mean, he says this glibly, and everyone's standing there and clapping and saying, "Yeah, that's good." You can't do that. You can't bring down prices as a president the moment that you sit in the Oval Office. It's a lot of rubbish.
But what he can do and what he said on numerous occasions is he's just going to relax the legislation around being able to do fracking in the US. And he's often said in rallies, drill, baby, drill.
Yes.
So if he now relaxes the drilling rules and the fracking rules and all of these things, the price of energy could in fact come down because the market might be swamped. Whether it comes down 50% or not, no one knows. But I do know if it comes down 50%, it won't stay there for long.
Of course it won't.
Because if the price falls 50%, no one's making money anymore.
The frackers won't make money. Exactly. I mean, they can make money at 75, and it comes down to 65, then they have to turn the spigots off again.
Yeah, that's also just politics, man.
I hate politics.
I'm still amazed that we as a human race haven't worked out a better way to govern ourselves than with politicians.
I've worked it out, but it's too long for this show. I've come up with a much better system, but that's okay. And you would be part of it, of course. But I have worked out, and democracy would also be thrown out the window. If I was president of the universe, I would immediately revamp the whole system. But anyway, go on.
Yeah, if I was president of the universe, the first thing I would legislate, or first thing I would decree, is that you cannot have different fittings for light bulbs. every fitting has got to be exactly the same.
Terribly important. And also cell phone charges.
The next thing I would decree, your cell phone charges, but we're getting there in the cell phone charges. The next thing I would decree is every screw must take a star screwdriver and a flat screwdriver.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, so you've got a Phillips, which we call it in Europe. A Phillips, which is the star one, and the flat one, which is the ordinary one. So you've got to be, they've got to be interchangeable.
They've got to be adaptable. Got to be adaptable.
Okay.
The third thing I would decree is every nut and bolt manufactured must have the thread pitch or the thread size printed on the bolt.
You see, these are the semantics. This is why you would be the expert in terms of mechanics and engineering and that sort of thing.
And it's actually the commies that caused all of this problem.
Oh, thank you very much. Why?
They had British standard Wentworth thread. They had British standard thread. They had British standard pipe thread. They had British standard gas thread. They had 10 different thread patterns. And, of course, I restored British motor cars. And oh my goodness. And then when the Yanks got involved, sort of in the beginning of the Second World War, they just said, listen, guys, listen, one standard thread.
Mm.
So post the war, the thread pattern's not that bad because they said, you can't make part of it. You can't make a truck. We can't make a truck in the US. Then when it goes to the UK, you got no nuts and bolts to fix it because you characters use a different thread pattern. So they standardized it. They call it the national thread. And so post the Second World War, but a lot of the stuff was still using all this old stuff. I mean, it's interesting today on all your gas fittings, it's still British standard pipe fittings. So it's not metric, eh?
Well, yeah, it's the old imperial standards. But don't forget that the sun never set on the British Empire. The British Empire, 40% of the world was pink on the global map in the old days.
And the Industrial Revolution did start, so they had to find their way with thread patterns. But anyway, we're digressing, but that's what I would do the first couple
First thing would be the light bulbs, yeah?
If I was master of... Oh, and then electric plug fittings.
Here we go.
Oh, my goodness. Can't we just all have the same fitting for every electrical thing?
On this subject, I agree with you. You go to the airport and you say, where am I going now? I'm going to the Netherlands. What do they use there? And you have to go into a shop and say, I'm going to the Netherlands and I've got a South African plug here.
Yeah,
I need to convert it, etc. And you have to plug in three different devices in order to get power.
Yeah.
I agree with you on that one.
But also, I also think that you ever invented the two-pin socket.
That's stupid.
You should be banished.
Oh, yeah, they should be on an island somewhere.
Everyone just stand it. Just stand it. Make it easy for DIY people.
So we got plugs.
Yeah, anyway, yes.
Plugs, bulbs, nuts plugs, and bolts.
Light fittings, nuts and bolts.
You see, this is why my new system, which banishes democracy, will work, and we'll talk about it one day in the future over a glass of red wine or something. Wayne, do you ever get cravings? I'm talking about food now.
Oh, that's my problem, yeah.
Food cravings.
That's my biggest downfall. That's why... I'm overweight. Yes, I do definitively get cravings.
You don't have to be overweight. Cravings don't always lead to, mild obesity. It does. But sometimes I get something in my head. I'll be watching television. There'll be a cooking program on, and I'll say, I've got to have that. I've got to have those chicken wings, which is what happened to me yesterday. And I had to get chicken wings. So what did I do? I got chicken wings. And then I thought... I'm not going to go through this recipe that person's done because there's far too many ingredients. So what I did was I got these beautiful, plump, organic, or as they say in the Netherlands, bio chicken wings. They were delicious, and I poached them, first of all. I made up my own recipe. I poached them in water for between 8 to 10 minutes, something like that. I drained them off, put them in a bowl, squeezed lemon juice over them and put some salt and pepper in. Then I poured over a decent amount, but not too much, of very hot peri-peri sauce. And I stirred them all up. And then I thought, okay, that's a little bit too crude. I've got to have another layer of flavor. So I got a great big spoonful of honey, a really big spoonful of honey, and I stirred that in as well. I marinated them for about an hour. Then I put a pan on, extremely hot, and fried them. And as I was frying one side, I poured on toasted sesame seeds. Okay.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
It really was. And then I turned them over with a pair of tongs, which is one of the most useful implements in anybody's kitchen.
Yes.
I turned them all over. I poured some sesame seeds on the other side. 2 minutes either side, not quite charred, but certainly sealing in all that delicious flavour that I'd got from the poaching. And I have to say, Wayne, the combination of the peri-peri and the lemon juice and everything else and the honey, the sweetness with honey, I munched away like a maniac. It was brilliant.
No, it sounds, it truly does sound delicious because, you know, nice peri-peri. I mean, I'm a huge peri-peri fan.
Me too.
Truly am a huge peri. I buy peri-peri by the
gallon.
I buy two 1 liter bottles at a time
yeah.
from the Honey Rock. They sell their peri-peri, old Smirnoff vodka and Klipdrift brandy bottles, and you buy two. Well, I think it's 750, not 1 liter, but you buy two of them at. I buy two of them at a time.
Okay.
And it's delicious, and I have it with many, many things. And the, you know, a good peri-peri shouldn't burn your mouth.
No.
It shouldn't be killer hot. Now, I mean, I've done a huge study of peri-peri in the Greater Johannesburg area. And the Honey Rock is probably the best peri-peri, but I can promise you Sesco's comes close. Theirs is a little bit stronger. And then maybe third place, but these are all very, very closely contested positions, is the Troyville Hotel's also got very good peri-peri.
Yeah, you see, there's a difference between being a good hot peri-peri and something that's too harsh. It can be,
it's too hot, yeah.
Yeah. Do you ever make your own? Do you ever try making your own with the?
No, I've never actually tried that.
Actually, if you've got the top three contenders that you've just described,
They certainly the Honey Rock, you know, when you buy their domestic variant, the homemade one, it's not expensive. I mean, it's about, I think it's about 80 rand or 100 rand for the 750 mils. And
that's not bad.
I mean, 750 mils of peri-peri is a lot, eh?
Yeah, it is. That'll last you a couple of months.
Yeah, the 2 liters last me maybe 3-4 months. But as I said, I have a lot of peri-peri. I have it on my eggs in the morning. I have a lot of peri-peri.
Okay.
I like it.
Okay, yes, I can tell. Okay, Wayne, thank you very much for your time. As always, Wayne McCurry is a portfolio manager at FNB Wealth and Investment in Johannesburg. And that was Wayne on Wednesday. The views and opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of Lindsay Williams and various contributors and do not reflect the policy, position, or opinion of any other agency, organization, employer, or company associated with strictlybusinesspodcast.com. Assumptions made on the analyses are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the speaker or the author. And since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to change, revision, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity.